Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to Renee's Heart to Heart. This is Renee. Thanks for joining us this morning. Today's going to be a little continuing on the story about the young girl who went into a comatose state and has been declared brain dead after a routine tonsillectomy. Over the weekend, I kept an eye on everything on the news, and this morning I missed it. I was in the shower, but my husband tells me that they announced today that at 5 p.m. this evening they will discontinue the life support system. However, over the weekend there was lots of controversy. Many different rest homes, hospitals, a hospital in New York that went unnamed, actually offered to keep this young woman, Jahi, on life support in their hospital. But apparently the repercussions of these offers were a little bit more than what some of these other hospitals were willing to take on. There seems to be some, I don't know, some thoughts on the fact that if we don't respect what our medical arena is explaining to us, then that's a bit of a slap in the face. However, I did not see any more mention, nor have I been able to find anything online this morning in regard to how they feel about the book that the family resorted to when they first understood what was happening, and the information about the fact that the brain isn't, just because the brain is shut down doesn't necessarily mean that it has given up. So on my search, though, I found other stories. I found stories about a young girl who has been in a comatose state but breathing on her own. And the only thing she could do since, it's been over a year, is roll her eyes. So she's actually being euthanized. So it appears in my research, it appears that there's a lot of things that are being done that we've always thought were, just not available, not our right, so to speak. I thought Jack Kevorkian got in a lot of trouble for euthanizing people who were dying. Didn't he do jail time and get in all kinds of in problems? I mean, I realized that he didn't stay in jail, and I realized that he ended up fighting until, I don't know if you would call it winning, but he got recognized as somebody who was trying to do something good for people. I feel it necessary to mention at this point in time that both my brother and sister, when they succumbed to the cancer that was invading their bodies, wanted to die. There were no ifs, ands, or buts about it. I caught my brother pouring whiskey into his peg tube, and my sister just totally gave up. She would sip on water. She wanted nothing else. She wanted to go. So this is a dilemma. This is really a dilemma, because we do have the knowledge and the availability of prolonging life. However, is that what we're supposed to be doing with all this knowledge? Is that what we're supposed to be doing for the people that we love, making them hang on in a place that is painful, is delusional, is not anything close to what being alive is about? Mind you, I stated last week, and I stand by this, if it's your child, it's a whole other story, because you never want to give up hope. You always want to believe that in the next 15 minutes, somebody's going to give you the fix the anecdote, the everything that's going to stop this horrible thing that's taking your child away from you. But in reality, we have to think about this. It's just like I talk to elderly people all the time. I'm not going to say to you that any of them has said to me, this life isn't what I wanted it to be anymore. I just as soon move on. Because I've not had anybody that is in a relatively healthy place say that to me. However, when you spend time with people with Alzheimer's, when you spend time with people who are so ill that they have to be continually sedated so that there's some comfort involved, you certainly understand the thought process of moving on. I'm going to bring Shell in because we are going to talk about some of the the controversial ways of handling this that I was totally taken aback by. I thought we had some rights regarding what happens to our children, but I learn more and more every day that that's really not the way it is. That's really not the truth. Good morning, Shelley. How are you?
Good morning, and how are you?
I'm okay. I'm not too thrilled about doing this story this morning, maybe because it's too close to me in a couple different ways right now. But I did a lot of research all during the weekend, and everything I found, some of it, I'm not kidding you, I would print off like 10 sheets of something, and I'd have to sit out in the other room all by myself and read it. Because it's so convoluted. At the end of the day, it appears as though procedural process that actually ends a life. It's all up to the powers that be, and most of them have to do with the administrators and the higher medical employees at a hospital as to who makes the decision whether somebody is taken off life support or not. They prefer the family to agree, to not fight them, to not go to court, to respect their evaluation of what's going on. But in a lot of cases, the families don't. And like we talked about Friday when we recapped on this story, it appears as though there's nobody with any kind of diplomacy that goes in and says, okay, here, you know, you can do this, you can do that, this is what we suggest. There's nobody that really knows how to talk to people in a scenario like this, which is too bad. Especially with all the other avenues that we have now that actually help with the transitioning of losing somebody, like hospice and hospice care, and like some of your rest homes that are set up to say goodbye to the relatively healthy, but the people that can't live on their own any longer. So right. It seems to me that there's nobody that's equipped to come to a true understanding of what's happening without making the parents feel like, you know what's happening here. You're making a parent feel guilty.
One of the things that you had said last week, and I think a lot of people realize this, but it's kind of difficult to think about it, is that very often the decisions are made from a fiduciary standpoint, a financial standpoint, money, what it's going to cost the hospital to keep that person alive. If the insurances would continue paying, it wouldn't even be a discussion. I told you I watched this show, The Untold Stories of the ER. It's on the TLC channel. It happens to be a very good show, and it's because that's the type of medicine that fascinates me. Emergency medicine, I think, is extraordinary because here you've got people coming in with you know, they've had like work injuries, their, you know, part of their body has been cut off and they're putting it back on, that, you know, those type of stories. They're incredible. But there was one that made me think of this story and how decisions are made based on money sometimes and not reality. This woman came in with a rattlesnake bite, and her leg was just swelling up abnormally. It was, like, incredible, and she was just in tremendous pain. The hospital only had, like, a half a dozen vials of antivenom, and she was going to need a minimum of 15 vials. And every time they gave her a vial, her symptoms would subside, and then the minute that would wear off, and it would last for about 10 minutes, she would need a second vial. Every time they gave her another vial, her symptoms would subside, and then again it would wear off, and all the symptoms would come back again. And they knew how many vials it was going to take to save this woman's life, so they went to their sister hospitals. They were able to get a few more vials, but they didn't have enough to literally save this woman's life. And the administrator of the hospital told them they didn't have permission to go outside their network to area hospitals, that they would have to wait for them to convene a meeting the next morning of the board members. And the doctor told the administrator, he said, this woman won't be alive by the morning. He says, I've got to get these vials now. And the administrator told him, he said, if you go outside the network, he said, you're going to be brought up in front of the board and you could very likely lose your job. And the ER doctor went outside the network, got six more vials, and it did in fact save this woman's life. The end of the story was that he did not lose his job, but the fact that he even could have lost his job over something like that, that this administrator of the hospital wouldn't just see that this was something that there was no other choice about. He was going to wait and convene a session of administrators the next morning, knowing that this woman wouldn't be alive anymore. Meanwhile, she was a young woman. She had a family. She had her children there. I think she was in her early 40s. She was, other than this snake bite, she was in perfect health. So this was like a no-brainer. The antivenom was absolutely going to save this woman's life, but it would cost something like $1,000 a tube. And all this administrator was thinking about was the money. He was not thinking about whether or not this woman had the likelihood of surviving, whether or not this was the appropriate call. And unfortunately, I think in a lot of situations, that's where these decisions come from. They're not looking at the likelihood of whether or not this person is going to survive or not.
Well, and at the end of the day, though, see, that's one of the problems that I saw in all this stuff that I've researched, and that is the fact that if they don't listen to these people with the education and and this is all debatable, you understand, but what they're putting out there is if they have all these professionals that are giving their expertise as to whether or not something is doable, viable, all those kind of things, and they don't listen to them, then they get ridiculed for that as well, because then there's a whole bunch of controversy over why are those people sitting in those seats if they don't have the knowledge and the training to be able to make these decisions for us? What are we thinking? So there seems to be some controversy over all of that, as well as the obvious controversy over the life or death situation. But that would have really annoyed me to see a story like the one you're talking about.
Oh, my God. I credit the ER doctor because he was ready to lose his job over saving his woman's life. You know, there was no ends or buts. There was no way he wasn't going to follow through with this. And against the administrator's advice, he went ahead and he got the other six vials in from a non-sister hospital, one that wasn't in their affiliate network. And, thank God that the other, when he did go up in front of the board, they agreed with him. I think they sanctioned him for a week or something. I guess they didn't want him going rogue on them, but he didn't lose his job, which is which obviously is the appropriate outcome. But the fact that he was even brought up in front of the board of really, I mean, these people could have sued the hospital. See, that's the part I didn't understand. If I found out that the only reason you didn't save my wife was because you didn't want to go outside your network and there was antivenom at another hospital, I mean, wouldn't that have marred the image of this? I mean, they're not looking at the big picture to even not move forward on that. And I wonder how many other decisions that affect the life and death of a patient are made every day that people know nothing about, that is strictly from a financial standpoint and having nothing to do with the likelihood that this person will survive or not.
Well, I am afraid to say that there's that's usually the bottom line of everything. Usually the bottom line of everything. But like I said, if you are looking at the big picture from, you know, just stand back and look at the fact that there are political dinners that are given during every presidential race that cost you $50,000 a plate. $50,000 a plate. $10,000 a plate. It's like, it blows me away. It really, really blows me away. And, of course, struggling with money my whole life, never knowing anything other than struggling with money. Even when I've made good money, it seems like whatever's going on, it gets used up. And then when I don't have any, somehow I get by too. But it like blows me away to see the way some people live. And their consciousness is I don't know. I don't know where it is. It's just about I don't get it.
One of my issues is when you look at some of the things that the government spends money on, and we're kind of getting away from the topic of this show, so I'll just make this comment, then we'll probably do a different show about this. But, you know, I am a proponent of socialized medicine. You know, people say, oh, that's like communism and all that. No, it's not. What I'm talking about socialized medicine is nobody should ever not be able to get medical care. I don't think that medicine should be only available to people that are working full-time, only available to people that are wealthy enough to afford the best surgeon. I think that doctors and nurses deserve respect. I think they deserve to be considered, you know, in the hierarchy of professions, because it takes a lot of dedication to become a doctor. But I don't think that it should only be available to people that have the financial wherewithal. One of the problems in this country is that so many people are so sick. And although I don't believe in medical solutions for everything, if it was socialized, if medical options were available, then you wouldn't have insurance companies dictating what healing modality is appropriate based on the ability for the insurance company to pay for it. You would have a mixture of both Western and Eastern philosophies. You would have acupuncture available to people. You would have like a Hippocrates Health Institute available to people, just as you would chemo for the people that believed in that. And I think that whatever healing modality is out there that has been proven to be successful, all right, should be available to people, and it should be available as something provided by the government for the people. And there are countries that have that, and I don't understand why the United States doesn't have it. It's always blown my mind that we have such an unhealthy country. There are more people sick in the United States than there are people that are healthy, and that is a shocking statistic. It's something I talk about in my book, and it's something that should not be permitted. You have the government bailing out banks that got themselves in trouble on their own to the tune of billions of dollars, but they're not doing anything to help the populace that's sick, that all you have to do is if you do something at the onset of an illness, you can prevent it from, you know, from really harming this individual. But 9 times out of 10, people don't have the money to get the medication they think they need. They don't look for other options because insurance isn't going to pay for it. And so here you're just creating a society that's sicker and sicker and sicker. And that's where depression comes from and crime comes from and the family values breaking down. So that spins out into a lot of the other issues we have. It's such a big, big topic, and it affects every other part of our life. So by creating some sort of, you know, this what I call socialized medicine, and that's probably not the right word for it, but to just have medicine available all the time, And other options available other than what an insurance company would pay for would be something our government can do, and I don't know why there's never been a movement to do it.
Well, like I said before, it all ends up on the bottom line, and it's all about who's going to benefit from the decisions that are made. But
well,
I'm sure
the pharmaceutical companies have a, because I know this has been brought up before, but I'm sure the pharmaceutical companies who make profits into the trillions of dollars, by the way, I'm sure that they've blocked it every time it was ever brought up, because if people knew about other options and had other options and the profits were taken out of it, I mean, you know, this industry would literally dissolve in a decade.
Well, I believe that those options are becoming more and more a part of everybody's everyday life. I mean, if you, on any of the social networks, there's people coming up all the time. People that I've known for years who are, all of a sudden, they're all doing, juicing. They're all going to Walmart. And there's a whole aisle of nothing but juicers. way back in 2001, when I first became associated with the Institute, I thought juice was something that you made where you just squeezed, your fruit and made juice. I didn't know that there was a whole other world of, you know, actually fortifying your body with a special...
green drinks, things like that, yeah.
And the healthy smoothies and the things made with almond milk and fresh vegetables and all this kind of stuff. I didn't know any of that. Well, now that has, in 12 years, has actually now 13 years, has become household knowledge. So there are things that are happening that will make things better. But at the end of the day, it's still convoluted as to what kind of decision is made in a scenario like this. Everything that I read...
For some reason, I guess the clock on my phone was off, and by the time I got in, you were already talking. I didn't hear the recap on the little 13-year-old girl. Is there any news on that front?
Yes.
I heard
yes.
you talking about your reaction to it, but I didn't hear if there's been any update, if the family's been able to do anything with the hospital.
Well, several hospitals offered to take this young woman into other hospitals, one in New York City that wasn't named. There was a couple rest homes closer in California that offered to keep her in their establishment until, you know, any changes occurred or any other decisions were made. And they all reneged at the last minute. And one of the reasons they reneged, apparently, and of course we only know what we're being told, Shelley, as usual, we're not on the inside. But what
exactly.
They're saying that the courts have given until tonight at 5:00. Now, I previously read that they gave her until the 30th of December, but apparently that also has been reestablished. So today is, today is the 30th, though. That's right. Today is the 30th. So
to the 31st. I thought they had till New Year's Eve. It did say the 30th originally?
They said the 30th. So,
I'm flabbergasted that the places that offer us reneging. What was their reason for reneging? I didn't understand that.
They don't want to question the validity, the integrity, or the professionalism of all the medical personnel, real high-up physicians and surgeons.
That's what you were talking about. Yeah, I heard that part, but I didn't know what it was in relation to. That doesn't make much sense to me.
I can see their point of view. It's not like I don't see their point of view, but I don't know that if the validity is great enough to make this decision. However, and this is not to say that I don't necessarily believe that this little girl is going to survive either. I don't know. But the point of fact is, if if there is some controversy over the brain activity and the disconnection and all the things that we're being taught today about the human body, I do think there's some room for some controversy. And if I were her mother, that's what I'd be hanging on to with both hands, both feet, and my teeth. I wouldn't think of anything else. If somebody said to me, you know what, Rini, there's this little tiny itty-bitty possibility that there could be a disconnect going on in there because of the bleeding in the brain, and once all the blood subsides or something happens, there could be another connection, and she may survive. As long as one person said that to me, that's what I'd be clinging to, and I believe that that's probably what these parents are clinging to. Now, what bothers me is the fact that they have no rights here. I thought there had to be an agreement made between the parents of a minor and the powers that be, or between the spouse of a patient and the powers that be. And it's looking more and more like once they make a decision, it's no longer up to you. You lose your, you lose any power that you may have believed you had. So,
right.
Something about that bothers me. But remember the night that I found out that you didn't have to ask permission to take a picture of a kid, and the day we talked about the fact that in high school, kids under the age of 18 can give blood without a parent's consent. There's a lot of things now that are, for me, I mean, you're still liable if your kid goes out and hurts somebody and they're 17, you're still responsible for them. And yet, they're opening up doors for them to make decisions about, like, giving blood. Not that I'm against my 17-year-old grandson giving blood. I applaud the fact that he understands the worth of that. But he can't sign a contract, you know? Remember years ago when you tried to bring in a young girl and she was going to sign the contract and the parents gave her a credit card? I don't remember all the stuff. And I said, Cal, we can't sign a contract with her to get her in here. Her parents
right.
have got to sign a contract. And
that's right.
My years in the hotel business taught me that on spring break.
Mm-hmm.
When parents, 17-year-olds on spring break with a credit card. We used to have to get all kinds of paper signed by the parents saying that they could use that credit card. Of course,
right.
now 17-year-old kids get a debit card, and it's totally different. But then it's also backed by money, so it's not contractual. It's money that's actually available. Anyway, that gets all convoluted. But the fact of the matter is, a lot of these things are changing right beneath our noses and taking away more and more parental rights and responsibilities. So this is the, you know, this is the cherry on top. My child is in this much trouble. You know, when my second son, Michael, got hit by the car, and I'm in a little tiny room with a woman who's trying to find an appropriate hospital for Mikey to be in because he's still in a coma after 10 days. And they're talking to Jackson Memorial on the speakerphone, and I hear the lady on the speakerphone say, we already know about this case. There's no available insurance. We don't have a bed available.
Wow.
And tears just welled up in my face. I looked at the woman and I started yelling. I said, you're telling me you're going to let my son die because I have no insurance? Is that what you're saying to me? And and they hung up on the phone. I wrote
you're
a big
probably,
long letter.
Yeah,
wanted to
wow.
send it. Sentinel and our lawyer wouldn't let me. He said, you don't want to get everybody angry with you, Rini. You want them to work with you. Well, as luck would have it, my Denny's insurance kicked in, and the next surgeries that Mike had to have, they separated from the original injury. So my Denny's insurance picked up a big part of the tab for Mike to be in Jackson Memorial and have his throat fixed. But they were going to let him die. There no ifs, ands, or buts about it. They were going to let him die. And I've never forgotten that, and as long as I live, I will never forget that. But that's the way the world runs. And at the end of the day, like you just said 10 minutes ago, bottom line is what calls the shots. Now, this young woman, no money for this young woman either, so obviously money has a lot to do with this. But even when hospitals stepped up and said she can come there, you know, then they've changed their minds, and I'm sure that's because they're being pressured and being told you simply can't do that, because then you make everybody else look bad and yourself look good. It's all political, controversial. The paperwork that I pulled up, too, in regard to who has the say, in a lot of cases, it comes to a judge. It comes to a judge, and the judge has to intervene between the hospital administrative staff and upper physicians and things like that versus the parents, and a judge hears the case from both sides, and he makes a decision, which is kind of what happened here, and it happened very quickly. But at the end of the day, there is no steadfast rule over who says, you know, unless you're a billionaire and you can just say, okay, I'll buy my own life support system and keep her at home and hire somebody to take care of her. And by the way, there are people that do that today. There are people who keep vegetative state children, near drowning children and things like that in their home for many, many years until those children pass, and they do it in their own care and their own administration of what happens to them.
Well, you had actually read stories like, how many stories like that did you read? I mean, there was more than one?
Oh, yeah, there's a lot. Well, and I through my lifetime, I knew a family that was in charge of, I can't remember the acronym, it's parents of nearly drowned. I don't remember exactly how it was worded, but kids that were underwater and their brain got no oxygen for any length of time, but then they were saved and they started breathing again. And in a lot of cases, they breathe on their own, with a little bit of oxygen supply, but they can, their lungs still work and everything. But in most cases, they are bedridden and, you know, have no quality of life. And Pond, I think it's called. Parents of Near Drowned, P-O-N-D. And I knew a family. They had four children, and their oldest child this happened to. And they had a hospital room set up in their house in Pompano, and they took her three times a week to a rehab, which meant they carried her out in one of those, not a wheelchair, but it's like a handicap chair where their head is even, like, strapped to the back so that they can sit up straight.
Right,
and they took
right.
All the other kids take care of her. So it was their decision because they took on the labor of love and took care of that child. I doubt very seriously if that child is still with us. I haven't been in that neighborhood in 20 years, but that's what they did.
And you didn't read any stories of a child that was in a state like that that eventually recovered?
I know there's
stories of adults that have been in comas after catastrophic accidents and were believed to be in a vegetative state, and then sometimes months later come out of the coma with their entire their memory, except for right around the accident, but the rest of their memory completely intact. So there is more that goes on with our brains than medical science is aware of, but in the same token, if you have, you know, just playing the other side of the coin right now, if you have, you know, 99.9% of the population have this particular effect and they don't recover and there is no real life force there, you know, how do you make a determination? And if there is no life force, now kind of going into a little spiritual realm here, why doesn't the soul leave the body then? That's what confuses me. That why is the life force because there is a life force to us. Why is the life force holding on if the body basically is not usable anymore? So that's a little confusing to me, because the soul isn't something that's controlled by our conscious mind. So that's something that's a curiosity to me from a spiritual standpoint.
Ask you a question. That's a really, really, really good question, honey. A really good question. And how do you know it doesn't?
Well, if it doesn't, the body can't sustain itself without a soul. The soul is basically like our, basically it's like our battery pack. Once the soul leaves the body doesn't function. That's why people that have been assumed dead were, even though the equipment at hospitals and things like that couldn't pick it up anymore, the soul was still connected somehow, and that's why these people, an hour after no breathing, no oxygen, which according to medical science would cause brain damage, these people, all of a sudden something happens and the body revives, and the people have complete cognitive abilities, they have all their memories and everything, no brain damage. Medical science can't explain these, like, people coming back after they've been deemed dead, where it's past that three-minute mark. I mean, sometimes this happens an hour later or whatever. Like I told you, that man or woman, I think it was a man, that fell out of the back of that ambulance time. I mean, here they're being transported to the coroner's office, and the ambulance gets in an accident. The guy's thrown out the back, and the compression of hitting the ground started his heart. Well, the only way that could happen is if the soul was still attached to the body somehow, you know? So it's an intriguing subject to me, and it makes me wonder what's really going on with these patients that are in vegetative states or brain dead, and, you know, and like some of the people that do come back, although it only happened rarely, they say that they're aware of conversations happening around them. They talk about them. It's almost like they're aware of their surroundings. Even though nothing was showing up on the monitors that there was any brain activity, they were aware of what was going on around them. So it's like, how do you explain that?
Well, like I mentioned before, my Michael remembers me talking to him and trying to answer me and not being able to, thinking he was saying things out loud and realizing that his, you know, he didn't have a voice. He just had a kind of a conscious awareness of the fact that he could hear me and was trying to answer me but could not. But of course, talking about your soul and your what a soul means to you, I think everybody has a different opinion of what our souls do for us. And of course, in the world of religion and things like that, there's a lot of controversy about our souls. And for me, I feel a little bit differently about it. I think your soul is your essence, but your body is, you know, is like your vehicle. So it doesn't surprise me that a vehicle can keep on keeping on without any life in them, for any number of reasons. And a lot of times it's just because the muscles that are working are strong enough to keep on going. So it's just like your heart. You're ravaged by cancer, and the cancer is taking away and causing pain and depleting all the other organs. But if you have a really strong heart, it's unconscionable how long you can survive with your heart beating and keeping the rest of your body, when the rest of your body is like saying, okay, already, shut up and leave us alone, and it won't, because it's still strong enough going. But I have, for me, it wouldn't surprise me, and of course this is all theoretical or I don't even know what you want to call it, but for me, a soul can leave you and the body can still function like a vehicle. And I wish I was a whole lot smarter, so I could figure out things like that and have them be meaningful. I can't. It's just what I believe, that souls can move on and be where they need to be when they need to be there. But if your body's not only laying there and breathing. Now, one of the stories that I mentioned this morning very quickly that I took me by surprise, I guess it was in 2012, I wasn't able to open up the story because my computer kept freezing this morning, so I'm going to check it out when I can get into it. And that is another 13-year-old girl who they show a picture of just laying on the couch in her parents' home. And she is, you know, alive, but she's her brain apparently is gone, but the rest of her body is working. And it's not life support that's keeping her alive. She's just breathing. And all she can do is roll her eyes. She can't move any other part of her body. She can roll her eyes. So now a court has deemed that she needs to be euthanized. So
wow.
I didn't think that ever happened. I didn't think there were any powers that be that were in a position to, you know, I don't know. For me, I am going to research this story and get more information about it, but it, like, blew me away.
So wait a minute. So did this young girl, and again, you don't know all the details, but were you able to find out what, so she's home and the courts are telling the parents that even though they've taken her home, they have to euthanize her? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Yes. Well, and I, like I said, because I couldn't open up the story, maybe the parents okay with this because maybe this is, you know, this is tearing them apart. I can understand how it would be. But even without that, that just shows you what, again, you know, we're just all so different. And some people go on for years and years and years and years without any stimulation from outside forces, no breathing machine, no nothing, but they're gone. And I have to wonder what will happen tonight at 5 o'clock if they remove this other 13-year-old girl, the one that had the tonsillectomy, if they remove her from life support and she continues breathing.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing when you were talking about that. What if her body keeps going? Then what does the hospital do at that point?
Because
if she does, you know, based on everything we've talked about, just like you said, just because the body continues going doesn't mean that the brain is ever going to regain any cognitive ability. And it really is a fascinating subject because it's, like I said, some people have gone from a vegetative state to regaining full consciousness. I believe most people probably don't. I think those are exceptions to the rule. But why does somebody go into that state and then regain their faculties? You know, is there anybody who has seen a difference? You know, like what would cause a person to regain consciousness, and why can't they apply that knowledge to people that haven't yet? There has to be some difference in either the type of the injury or the constitution of the person or something, and I'm wondering how much research has ever been done into that.
I don't know. And I, you know, for me, it's kind of scary to think that anybody, I don't... Aren't there some things that we shouldn't have a say in? Aren't there some things like that really don't fall into any living person's realm of, I don't know.
Like, I don't think government should have the authority to tell you that your kids have to be vaccinated or that a child has to be given chemotherapy. Remember what happened with that young Canadian boy that came to Hippocrates? And they were, when the parents were going to return to Canada, the Canadian government was going to seize the child and force the child to get chemo. Thank goodness that at, for the 6 weeks the child was at Hippocrates, the brain tumor had reduced something like 45% in mass, which was enough for the hospital to say, okay, yeah, whatever they're doing is working, and they decided not to force the child to get chemo. But the fact is that the parents did not, the child probably would not have survived. I don't know if you remember what he looked like. And he had had two surgeries up to that point. The child was very frail, could barely stand up. He had a gray pallor. The child probably wouldn't have survived chemo. And the parents recognized that. They saw how weak their son was. But because they made the decision to try something holistic, the Canadian authorities were going to basically take this child away from their parents. And there are some laws in the United States that work that way. I mean, that's ridiculous. You know, to think that we live in such a great country, and the United States is a great country, but there are some laws that are completely unconstitutional that are driven strictly by the profits of the pharmaceutical companies. And it's I don't think people really understand how powerful that particular industry is with regard to making laws and things like that. But that's frightening when you can think that, you know, like if you don't want to vaccinate your children, you have to jump through hoops of fire. The schools are told to tell you that you're not allowed. I mean, it's happened to my niece several times. Every time she tries to opt out, the schools threaten her. They tell her that it's not legal, and she's like, of course it's legal. They won't give her the forms. The schools are supposed to give you the forms to opt out, but they really make a big deal out of it. And, you know, it's surprising that there's just so much misinformation out there about vaccinations and that the schools are almost put in a position to be an additional sales force for the pharmaceutical company, making sure that people get these things. And, you know, vaccinations don't protect us anyway. So that's a whole other topic.
Well, I'm while you've been talking, I got back into this page, and apparently this is some kind of a I don't know, some kind of a joke. Some kind of a joke. Brain dead teen only capable of rolling eyes and texting to be euthanized. The parents of 13-year-old Caitlin Teagart have decided to end her life, saying she can now do nothing but lay on the couch and whine about things being gay. And there's a story to read. Is this for real? Just take all of her stuff away, her phone, her computer, and her crap, and make her get out and do a boot camp on her ass. That will wake her the hell up. This is some of the, no, it's not real. The Onion is fake news site completely built on satire. It is fictitious.
Oh, yeah, because they're saying, like, because she just sits on the couch and rolls her eyes and texts. Oh, I get it.
Yeah.
It's kind of a joke, but yeah.
But, you know, what's scary, what's unkind about this is in the same news where I find stories about somebody who's really, you know, people's sense of humor. I always thought I had a great sense of humor. I love to laugh, and I love things that are satirical as well as, you know, making fun of myself. I'm a big proponent of laughing, the world laughs with you kind of a deal. But something like that for me is just unkind. And I think that whoever started, I'm going to have to research what Onion is now, but according to what I just perused, it's a site that just talks about things that are, in essence, making fun of real trauma. Here you have a girl who had a simple tonsillectomy, and the blood seeped into her brain, and now she is in a comatose state at the age of 13, and somebody thinks it's funny to write a story about a girl who just lays on the couch and texts and talks about everything being gay, and they're going to euthanize her. I, you know, that's not funny to me.
Well, see, the whole thing is that, you know, to say that a teen is laying on a couch, rolling their eyes and texting and deeming them brain dead is almost a cliche. It's kind of funny. But the problem with this satirical coverage is that they've taken it too far, talking about the family, trying to move to euthanizer and that kind of stuff. Now you've taken the joke and you've made it too disturbing. It's not funny anymore. And that's
right.
Part of the problem with the sense of humor today, with a lot of the TV shows I watch and stuff. They go too far. They're too insensitive. They're pulling us too far from normal human compassion. Some of the shows that are out are wonderful because it's all about human compassion and the foibles of people and how people can make mistakes and yet they still love each other. And, you know, and those type of shows are fun. There's some comedies, there's some dramas on right now that are actually decent to watch because they maintain decent values, you know. But I would say a good portion of the shows on TV today actually advocate being a slacker, advocate being lazy, advocate being disrespectful, being sneaky, going behind other people's backs. You know, if you see shows like that where somebody does something like that, and then all hell breaks loose from them, you know, those are the ones that are kind of funny. Although I don't like some of the slapstick ones. But a lot of the shows actually show the person doing all the wrong things being rewarded for it. And I think that's terrible. And when you have young people watching it, it really perverts their sense of decency and what's right because they're watching television. And, of course, everything you watch on television has to be true. That's what people think. So if they're watching a show that's showing a particular behavior, they think that behavior is not only acceptable, but they think it's normal. It's the way they're supposed to act, and it's really not. And I don't know why so many of these shows have been created. Some of the adult cartoons fall into that genre, and I find them offensive. I can't watch them, you know. But and a lot of this type of sick humor has evolved in the last 10-20 years, and I don't quite understand it. I don't understand the level of insensitivity, the level of inappropriateness, and you know, I just think it's way overboard. I completely agree with you on that. I think the beginning premise could be a little funny, you know, oh, what is this kid brain dead? Because, you know, people say that, but they say it as a joke, and then to leave it at that, you know. But to take it to the point they did is they stepped over a line of acceptability for me.
Well, that's the way I feel, especially when those kind of things are going on in real life. You know, it's okay to...
do you think that story was created on the heels of this other story? I mean, or has that other story been out there for a long time? Is there any way of telling when it was actually created? I'm curious as to if it really was in response to the story about the young girl with the tonsillectomy.
Well, it's right next to it. When you pull up, when you just put in, you know, tonsillectomy, 13-year-old with tonsillectomy, brain dead, or something like that, if you put that in, then this story is right in there with it, right, like steps away from it. So it's
right, but there's usually creation date. You can see posted. Usually underneath the story it says posted on a particular date. Is there anything there that says that on the one, the satirical one?
Yeah, it started in 2012, so it's been on the Internet for a year. But now it's coming
right,
up.
So it probably wasn't in relation to this. If it was in relation to this story, it would be more angry. It was just in bad taste. But it would be worse if it was put out there in response to the story that we're dealing with right now.
Mhm. Yeah. So it's like I said, it's just not in good taste, like you said. But there's like shit. There's like 30 stories of it from all different places. So other people picked up on it and all that kind of stuff. But the point is here is that, you know, to somebody who's in the throes of something like that, it's not all that damn funny. It's just, like you said, in bad taste. But as far as the other young woman is concerned, the 13-year-old that is going to have everything disconnected tonight at 5 o'clock. We will, you know, we'll be back tomorrow morning and we'll talk about that and see what happens through the night. My heart goes out to the family, and I certainly think that there needs to be some explanations made as to how this happened to begin with. And again, I'm not seeing any kind of stories about what kind of responsibilities are being accepted by the powers that be at a hospital. And obviously, there's a lot more to this story than a simple tonsillectomy and then bleeding in the brain. So something will have to come to light eventually in regard to how this even happened.
I'm actually surprised that there hasn't been more explanation as to what her overall health was, you know, if it was more serious, like case in point, like when I was talking about mine. I mean, I was desperately, desperately ill when I went in for my tonsillectomy, you know, and you know, and like I said, my parents were warm, and I'm really curious as to whether or not this girl was sicker, or was it just swollen tonsils, or was, were, obviously there were other things going on with her, either that or somebody made a mistake, like did they give her too much anesthesia, did they fry her brain during surgery? I mean, you know, I wonder if it's ever going to be divulged whether or not it was a health reason, that there were other things wrong with her, or did the hospital make a mistake and cause this? So it's, yeah, it's a frustrating case because the media is covering more of the situation from a legal standpoint, like, you know, are they going to leave the child on life support or something like that, and not talking about the facts around what happened to begin with. It's like the real story isn't even being covered anymore.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What's the girl's name, by the way? The young girl's name?
In which one?
The one we were talking about, the one we're talking about right now, because I wanted to see if I could do some additional research myself.
The one that's being, her name is, wait a minute, I don't have it on my page, Caitlin something. Wait a minute and I'll find it.
Okay.
Caitlin Teagart, T-E-A-G-A-R-T. And Caitlin is C-A-I-T-L-I-N.
C-E-A?
C-A-I-T-L-I-N. T-E-A-G-A-R-T.
All right. Okay. Yeah, and then that's the young girl with the tonsillectomy.
No. No. That's the girl that can only roll her eyes.
Yeah, but that's fake. Sorry, I don't care about that one. I want to know about the 13-year-old who's
really sick. Jahi McMath, JAHIMC,
MATH. Jahi. Right. That sounds more.
We're okay. About out of time. No, I want to remind everybody that tomorrow we'll be going through the Bullies to Buddies workbook. So, are having problems at home with your school-age kids and you suspect that something might be going on, this book will absolutely positively help you, give you some guidelines. Bye. Did I lose you?
No, I'm still here. How big is the book?
Oh, it's big. It's a big workbook. But we won't go through all of the pages, just the parts where he's given us. But it's got 140 pages.
Wow.
So at any rate, I want to let everybody know that we'll be back tomorrow doing the workbook and talking about Bullies to Buddies. And Wednesday we will be off the air because it's New Year's Day, and Thursday we'll be back. And Thursday we're going to talk some more about some of the answers to drug use when you have a teenager. I've been doing some ongoing research with this for friends and other things, and we're going to talk about that some more. So I want to wish everybody a great day today, and go out there and make it the best day you can make it. God bless. Thanks, Shel. Talk to you later.
All right. Thanks, Reen. Have a wonderful day, everyone. Speak to you tomorrow.